Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. I hope that you're enjoying this fire hose of information. And I hope that you've been listening to all of these different segments regarding the ratification debates. Because as we've journeyed through these different states, even though they may be uniquely different and disparate, where they're not really comparable as far as how they look at and perceive and their paradigms, but they use very similar language in addressing very specific clauses. And I mean disparate by the fact that if you look at Massachusetts, Massachusetts was very religiously focused. In North Carolina, they were more focused on the legality, slavery, those types of things. So there was some real disparate ratification debates or differences between the states and how they focused on, you know, what this thing was going to mean and how it was going to affect them. Again, in Pennsylvania, it was very interesting as well. That the paradigm was the people, you know, with people are the ultimate sovereigns and so forth. And so their focuses were definitely disparate. And so anyway, what I wanted to do was I wanted to kind of throw this out there, because as you go through these things, if you're involved in the party, then you should be able to use these nuggets in framing your platform. I'm working on a platform that can be used for any state whatsoever. This way, when the convention comes up, and I don't know when the convention is, but for the Republican convention, I'll look at it in our next break of when it's scheduled and where it's going to be. But the states are going to be showing up, and the states will be bringing forth their state resolutions. What's the best way to put this? How big would this be? How important would this be if more and more states started showing up with a very similar platform that the federal government only has these powers and we expect the federal government to comply to the Constitution? Because these platforms that are coming, we don't recognize, you know, we're not supporting, and we need to stop, you know, live abortion. All of those types of things regarding social issues of abortion, homosexual marriage, all of those things are solved completely by demanding full compliance to the Constitution and identifying what the federal government doesn't have jurisdiction and wiping it out. That means that your abortion problem goes, the federal government no longer has the ability to tell the states you have to allow abortions. The federal government can't be forcing states to, you have to allow homosexual marriages. They can't force the states into health care. Start creating the message, because it's these little things in the platform, bylaws, and these types of things that actually start, you know, honing and, you know, bringing the focus. It's kind of like sharpening that knife and bringing that edge to its ultimate sharpness, using the right angles, stones, and sharpening tools and so forth, files. Anyway, this is the time of year where people start thinking, and as a matter of fact, if you're involved in your party, you've probably been hearing people talk about their platform. They do this every 2 years. This isn't just a one-time thing. This is something, and some places actually work on their platform year-round, or at least once a year. And so why are you not getting involved, especially as a constitutionalist? You should be getting involved, because you become a rock star in the party, because you're the guy that understands the Constitution. You're the gal. You're the person that understands the Constitution. I hate being politically correct anyway, but I understand why people don't You know, they're not all guys. I get it. Anyway, I'm sorry for digressing. But my point is that I really want to make this point. How great would it be if all of a sudden we had about four or five states show up to the National Committee convention for, you know, basically nominating Trump for the party, and they start talking about, you know, we don't care about all these things. We just want you to comply to the we want the federal government to comply. If every state started focusing in that manner, what do you think the candidates would start doing? Oh, this is the platform. Do you accept this? Well, I don't know. I remember, I'm just going to go down this little aside or on this little tangent. I remember during the debates, I think it was in 2012, where Rick Perry, I believe it was Governor Perry, the governor of Texas, that was talking about unconstitutional things. Social Security was unconstitutional and so forth. And he was, you know, really pounding on that. And then in one of the debates, because he was leading at that point in time, he basically was, you know, cornered saying, hey, do you really believe this? And at that point in time, he said no. And I go, see, the guy had no backbone. He had no integrity. The fact is, it is unconstitutional. The fact is that we have to fix it. And the fact is, we have to fix it so that people don't get hurt. And there's a way to do that. As a matter of fact, I love Milton Friedman. And what he suggested is just actualizing it. Let's just end this and actualize what we owe and just do it. We pay people off, but we don't tax people anymore for Social Security. We may have to raise taxes in other ways, but the bottom line is we owe it to the people who paid into this, and we promised that we were going to do this, but people growing up and everybody else knows that when they retire, they will not be able to count on that, that they're going to have to get their own retirement plan. Retirement plans, if you want to have one, they're great. I don't think that, you know, retirement is that cool anyway. You're talking to a person that's retired twice, and here I am working. I believe it is important that we constantly stay active, that we constantly work. And if we can be productive, that's the best thing for us, because it keeps our, you know, it keeps, let me see here, what's the best way to say this? It makes our lives relevant, because we're still doing, we're still contributing. I know people that, oh, you know, they just dream of retirement and that they're just going to live on the beach and travel and do all these things. And I go, you know, do you have that kind of money? There are people that have that kind of money, but most people don't. I mean, if you're in the middle class, most middle class people do not have that kind of money. And that's just due to the fact that you never made that kind of money to live that kind of opulent lifestyle. Now, what happens, and I've seen this, where people will go and they'll retire and they will, you know, start spending that money. And before you know it, shoot, in a year or two, they're either back to work or they've changed their lifestyle to live within their means. There's an old saying, it's not an old saying, but it's one of my favorite albums. It's a King Crimson thing. And it's, be happy with what you have to be happy with. And if you can live by that rule, you'll keep yourself out of trouble, because it's always those people that are either keeping up with, you know, the world, the Joneses, whomever. Those are the people that always get in trouble. But anyway, we're going to get back into the Pennsylvania debates. We're heading into a break, but the couple of things I still need to tell you is that this show is sponsored by, or also sponsored by, ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And this is the only show that provides the academic evidence, especially these ratification debates are just baked with this evidence. And with this evidence, you should have an irrefutable understanding that Republic Review is the only process that will get the federal government into the framework of the Constitution once again. The other thing I want to ask, because I've been prodding you on this, are you still a part of the problem? The only way you are no longer a part of the problem is if you get involved in the solution. So with that, let me just plug our sponsor here. We have Red State Coffee that is sponsoring us. And if you go to our webpage, our homepage, you can actually click on Red State Coffee. That will take you there, as well as our contributors and sponsors. On that page, we have a link to Red State Coffee as well. So if you go there and you try Red State Coffee, please call us. Let us know what you think. This is a premium coffee, and we would hope that you would, you know, give us a favorable review, but we want you to give us an honest review. That way we can actually get you to, especially if it's a favorable review and we get that kind of feedback. The feedback I've had is basically a good, but I'm trying to get people to actually step up so that they're, you know, calling, leaving messages, because I want to capture you. I want to capture your opinion, your voice in what you think. It's robust. I mean, I can't speak to what coffee is. I hear robust, but I have no idea what that means. I have no, you know, there's certain things like with wine. I've never liked wine. It's just rotten grape juice, but there's people that love it. They're connoisseurs, and it's fruity, or they talk about all these different things. They go, really? It just tastes like rotten grape juice to me. But anyway, but we do want your views, your opinion, especially if you're a connoisseur, and you can really give us some really good feedback. We would love that. Anyway, we're heading into a hard break. So when we come back, we will be diving into the Pennsylvania ratification debates. Thank you so much. Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in, and let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so when we left off, I think we already kind of rolled through these different, help me out here. The last thing we actually read was Mr. Wilson, and he was talking about the different states, and he actually listed the states that did not have bills of rights. In other words, you know, here was these independent sovereign states that were under the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation, again, it was a confederation, so the states were basically the sovereigns. They had all the power. They gave hardly any power to the general government, which was the Continental Congress. And so, you know, here these people are complaining that, well, there's no Bill of Rights in this. Well, shoot, how many states don't even have a Bill of Rights? Are they not safe now? Because everybody was complaining about this. But anyway, the next one that we want to get into is basically Mr. Wilson, and not Mr. Wilson, I'm sorry, this is Mr. McClain. And he's talking about the Supremacy Clause here. And this is really, really important because the four clauses that the federal government has used to expand their powers, because the judges will tell you what this means. This means that the federal government is supreme in all things we deem necessary and proper. That was John Marshall in a few of his cases that he rattled off that said, you know, we can do whatever we need to because we're supreme, and we can, whatever we deem necessary and proper, we can do. See, this is why I tell you, and why I get upset when I hear a conservative say, all we need is the Constitution. No, you have to have the complementing documents that actually explain that, that give you the terms of the agreement, because that compact actually has clarifications and definitions that completely spell this out. And so here's what Mr. McClain said, and in declaring that this, quote, that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof. In other words, the laws will be made in pursuant to those or that will be tied specifically to the powers within this Constitution, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. I want you to understand here. When they say a treaty, they can go off and create a treaty and give themselves new powers. No, you got to understand, who do they make treaties with? The federal government has the power to make treaties with foreign entities. And that becomes the law of the land regarding trade and those things that are enumerated within the Constitution. So if all of a sudden the federal government made a treaty with the United Nations that says, we're going to bring in refugees, you know, just bring in hundreds of thousands of these people from this terrible place, the, you know, the plight and everything else, that would be actually violating the Constitution, because our Constitution has a natural process of immigration. The states never gave the federal government the ability to bring in block grants of people. They have to be brought in one at a time, case-by-case basis, via the system, not via a treaty. And so I'm just trying to make this very, very clear. It's the same thing with consumption. If the federal government makes a treaty that the only guns that we will use are, you know, shotguns, that is not, as a matter of fact, that would violate the Second Amendment. They do not have the power. So when you look at a treaty, you have to look at it in this way. Does the federal government have the fiduciary capabilities and responsibilities over the topic? Now, fiduciary is focused on the financial, but it's the same thing. Do they have the area of responsibility over the things that they are actually creating this treaty? Now, if it's foreign trade, it's one thing that we, you know, we'll buy their goods without any tariffs and they'll buy our goods. And that's a legitimate treaty. But to basically say that we're not going to be consuming any of our own goods and that you can't use guns anymore or anything that is actually protected or kept them from being able to do. And a good example is that you understand that a state is a state. So here's another really good example. With a state being a state, let's just say Florida, being a state that it is, and being a sovereign state that it is, and all of a sudden the government, federal government, comes along and says, we're going to sign a treaty with Cuba or with some small little country that's just off the shore of Florida, like maybe Puerto Rico. And Puerto Rico is going to say, we want the southern tip of Florida. And they go, okay, we're going to give them the southern tip of Florida. They can't. They don't have the power to give away any part of a sovereign state. That is that state. And as a matter of fact, that once the boundary of a state is defined, that becomes a sovereign. It's just like Russia. It's like Estonia. It's like Chile. It's like Mexico. States are states. They're sovereign, and they have full control over their own land. This is why I tell you that the federal government can't come along and make a treaty in a state. And a good example of this is with the indigenous, the Indians, the Eskimos, and all the different types of tribes and groups of people. They don't have the power to create treaties and then not give the states their land. That is a completely new treaty that overrules the old treaty in a territory. Because once a state has been defined, it is defined definitively that land is theirs. Now, what if this opens up a can of worms. And so I know people are going, well, what are we going to do? How do we do this? You give the people that are occupying, we call them reservations. If it's Inuits or whatever, they have this land that they've been given because that's their land. Well, you give them their land. You let them own that. They have the deeds and everything else. But because they're in that state, they have to comply. Now, if they don't like their land and they, you know, a really good example is outside Casper, the land value is going up. And right in that area is where there is a reservation. And I don't know the tribe or anything, but I do know that the people are looking and saying, we want to take some of that land back. No. Give that land to the Indians and are those people living there so that they own that. And then if you want that, you got to buy it from them. You don't take it because that's their land. That should be their land. It shouldn't be, you know, land that the federal government owns. What is this? The framers were really, really clear. They understood the tyranny of Britain and how Britain, you know, would own the forest and own the lands. And they'd give you little parcels. So that you, if you know, you wanted to grow food or what have you, you could. But, oh, by the way, you know, you could grow your own food, but you had to grow the products or the crops that they wanted you to grow for commercial purposes to make money. They were a mercantile system. That's why many of the planters in America, because Britain said you will be growing tobacco on your farms, then that's what they had to grow. But the fact of the matter is, the framers understood how the government, once it controls the land, once it controls the produce of the land, the productivity, those types of things, they weigh tyranny upon us. And so they created a system that the government couldn't control those lands. That's why in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, it defines the type of lands and buildings that the federal government can possess. They cannot possess a forest. Because Sherwood Forest came to mind, and they go, no way. We know that if the federal government can start owning and possessing land, it robs the people, it robs the states of their wealth and their resources. And so they don't have the ability to own those types of lands. And look at what they've been doing. Since 1849, they've been taking land from the states. And that's all unconstitutional. Oh, but they're better stewards. It doesn't matter. If you want them to literally be able to take your land, take your state land and everything else and change the Constitution, that's what you'll have to do. You have to amend the Constitution to grant them that power. And I'm hoping we never have that lapse, and I'll call it a momentary lapse of reason, but I hope we never have that lapse in thinking that giving the federal government greater powers domestically would be a good thing. Got to remember, these guys fight wars. They've got some pretty, you know, pretty hefty stuff when they go and project their force with the Navy and the Marine Corps. The question is, why do they have an army instead of the militias? The army should be dismantled, and it needs to go back to the militias. I kind of understand the Air Force itself, but as a matter of fact, I don't like the concept of Space Command or, you know, what Trump is doing, but There's no doubt we have, and they have the responsibility of national security, and there is no doubt that there's nefarious things that have been going on with Russia, China, and other nations in looking at how they are weaponizing satellites and using those types of things in nefarious ways. So we do need to look at, you know, keeping these things, you know, I'll just say under control better. But the fact of the matter is, when it comes to treaties, the federal government is limited to the powers it possesses that it can make treaties on. You just can't write a check out of an account you have no access to. And the access they have are only to the powers that they have. Anyway, with that, we're at a hard break. We will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so this next comment comes from Mr. Wilson. The last one was Mr. McKean. This is about enumerated powers and a Bill of Rights. Now, so this is... I'm going to back out for a minute. And as we've read through these different debates, they've all had a very similar position regarding a Bill of Rights. That when you have a constitution or a power of attorney that lists the, you know, the delegated powers that you're giving this government or a person, why would you need to list negative? So here's a good example. If you gave the power of attorney to somebody that was going to sell your property, why would you create a bill of or a bunch of exclusions when you've already just given them power to do something? In other words, it would be, you know, it'd be very controlling if you said, I want you to sell this property, but I don't want you to sell it to people, to a woman or any kind of women. I don't want to sell it to, you know, when you start creating exclusions like that to say, this is how I want you to sell it, then you are actually making, you know, that power of attorney too restrictive, or you could all of a sudden create this lapse in saying, well, you told me to sell this property, but you didn't tell me that I couldn't sell it for, you know, a penny, right? And so, you know, you may want to say that, you know, I'm going to give you this, you know, power to sell this property for the fair market value. But if you didn't put the nugatory that I couldn't sell it for a penny, well, at the point in time, and this was a charitable organization, so you have to be very specific with the power you delegate, but creating nugatory powers on top of a power that you've been very explicit with, this is the power you have, then to all of a sudden throw religion into the mix and say, well, but we don't want you to, you know, have any prayers that day that you sell, or it becomes ludicrous and it becomes outside of the box, because the only reason that you're creating a government is to do some very specific things. You're not wanting them to actually teach anybody, so you didn't give them the power to educate people. You didn't give them the power to administer and preach. You didn't give them the power to, provide health care and to, you know, fix people's owies. You're only giving them these powers. So why would you want to create this long laundry list of things? Now, the two, I've been very firm on this, the two amendments that should have been there, and another amendment that's not there that I honestly think should be included, is our first right, limiting the amount of people that a representative can represent. When they move you into a pool of 750,000 people, they're not representing you and they're not accountable to you, because regardless of how loud and squeaky you may be, you're still a small fish in a big sea. And having voice of who is representing you, that's why Washington and the framers didn't think that going over 30 would be a good idea. That's why they limited it to 30. And so if you really look at the Constitution did not allow them to actually, you know, stretch it the way they have, but they did create this ambiguity in Congress to start creating, you know, these limitations to seats and so forth. And that's how they've gotten there, instead of amending the Constitution. So I say we amend the Constitution and force, with Madison's 12th or First Amendment out of the 12, I think we need to force them into going back to representing 50,000 people. That's what this amendment would do. The other two amendments that I think were completely necessary to add that were a part of the Bill of Rights, but I just think that they should have added it to the Constitution, because in the Articles of Confederation, those exact same articles were in the Articles of Confederation. They were not a part of the Bill of Rights. And so with that, those two amendments are the 9th and 10th amendments, where all powers are reserved, you know, to the people, and can't, you know, powers that aren't given can't be construed, or powers that are given cannot be construed as something that is kept by the people and or the states and so forth. Anyway, let me get into this. There are two kinds. This is Mr. Wilson. There are two kinds of government. That where general power is intended, it are to be given to the legislature, and that where powers are particularly enumerated. In the last case, the implied result is that nothing more is intended to be given than what is so enumerated, unless it results from the nature of government itself. On the other hand, and a good case in point is the General Accounting Office. Well, if you're going to have buildings across the, you know, the world, the United States and so forth, emissaries for your embassies, those types of things, then you may need to have a General Accounting Office to buy the land and take care of the deeds and the facilities, those types of things. So that makes sense. Anyway, intended to be given and so enumerated, unless it results from the nature of government itself, like I just said. On the other hand, when general legislative powers are given, then the people part with their authority and, on the gentleman's principle of government, retain nothing. That's why they did not want to give them a general government like they had given Parliament. They, like all these other governments, they have been given general powers. But in a government like the proposed one, there can be no necessity for a Bill of Rights. For on my principle, the people never part with their power. Enumerate all things of men. I am sure, sir, that no gentleman in the late convention would have attempted such a thing. I believe the honorable speakers in opposition on this floor were members of the assembly which appointed delegates to that convention. If it had been thought proper to have sent them into the body, how luminous would the dark conclave have been? And basically what he's saying is, how much of the negative powers would they have been able to create to say, make sure you don't, you know, make sure you keep these powers and identify and enumerate all these negative powers. Anyway, Mr. Wilson goes on to this next one. This is a nice long one, so I will probably have to take a break after the first two paragraphs here. In the second place, we are told that there is no check upon the government, but the people. It is unfortunate, sir, if the superintending authority is allowed as a check, but I apprehend that in the very construction of this government, there are numerous checks. Okay? There are numerous checks between the different branches, between the states and the federal government, the people and the federal government, the people in the states, and so forth. Besides those expressly enumerated, the two branches of legislature are mutual checks upon each other. But this subject will be more properly discussed when we come to consider the form of government itself. The manner of introducing this Constitution by the recognition of the authority of the people is said to change the principle of the present Confederation and introduce a consolidating and absorbing government. In the Confederated Republic, the sovereignty of states, it is said, is not preserved. We are told that there cannot be two sovereigns and that a subordinate sovereignty is no sovereign. It will be worthwhile, Mr. President, to consider this objection at large. When I had the honor of speaking formally on this subject, I stated in a concise manner as possible the leading ideas that occurred to me to ascertain where the supreme and sovereign power resides. It has not been, nor I presume will it be denied, that somewhere there is, and of necessity must be, a supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority. This, I believe, may justly be termed the sovereign power, for from that gentleman, Mr. Finley's, account of the matter, it cannot be sovereign unless it is supreme. For, says he, a subordinate sovereignty is no sovereignty at all. I had the honor of observing that if the question was asked where the supreme power resided, I stated further that if a question was asked of a politician who had considered the subject with sufficient accuracy where the supreme power resided in our governments, he would answer that it was vested in the state constitutions. This opinion approaches near the truth, but does not reach it. For the truth is that the supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority remains with the people. I mention also that the practical recognition of this truth was reserved for the honor of this country. I recollect no constitution founded on this principle, but we have witnessed the improvement and enjoy the happiness of seeing it carried into practice. The great and penetrating mind of Locke seems to be the only one that pointed towards even the theory of this great truth. Now, he goes on, and we'll get to those following paragraphs when we come back from the break. But the point is that he's actually saying that the constitutions of the state is close to the truth, but the people, clearly, when we have elections, we get to choose whether we are. And if you look historically, the people have never exercised their absolute power because they are serving themselves, because they're electing people who are catering and pandering to, giving them financial aid, giving them medical care, and so forth. And so, in other words, we're no longer exercising our power for our benefit. We'll be right back after this.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so to finish this thought, or to finish this part of this observation that Mr. Wilson is providing, when I made the observation that some politicians would say the supreme power was lodged in our state constitutions, I did not suspect that the honorable gentleman from Westmoreland, Mr. Finley, was included in that description. But I find myself disappointed, for I imagined his opposition would arise from another consideration. His position is that the supreme power resides in the states as governments, and mine is that it resides in the people as the fountain of government, and that the people have not, that the people meant not, and the people ought not to part with it to any government whatsoever. In their hands, it remains secure. They can delegate it in such proportions to such bodies and in such terms and under such limitations as they think proper. I agree that the member in opposition, but there cannot be two sovereigns on the same subject. Now, let me throw this in here because In reading this, this is what really came clearly to me. We and they understood the dangers of the democracy, you know, giving the power to the people. They saw fit to create a representative type of government, investing in those who had the better understanding, because If you ask Madison and the framers, most of these men looked at the average citizen as dolts. They were uneducated. A lot of them were illiterate. These men were taking care of those. So the question is, did he really want these people to have the full control? And, you know, to be able to be that fountain of power, that they have say over everything? Or was it more brilliant to have a limited and defined constitution to grant them to do certain things, but to keep them from being able to do other things, such as using the public purse to control every aspect of our lives? That would be left to you and I to choose whether we were going to have our children get educated, whether we were going to have, you know, health care in our community, and so forth and so on. If you understand the concept of a democracy and that people have the ultimate power over all things, see, I get his point in principle that we are the fountain of power, that we should be creating constitutions, and within those constitutions, we delegate power and we watch jealously over that power that we have delegated to ensure that this state government, this county government, that this federal government does not assume or usurp any powers that are not delegated, and to keep them in check. And by using republic review, that is the process to putting them back into check. Because, my friends, everything we're looking at today is government that is so far out of check that it just boggles my mind. We have to do something about this. We have to, either we force this or they will force us into global subjugation. That's where we're heading. Anyway, this next one, Mr. Wilson says this, but it is not pretended that the line is drawn with mathematical precision. The inaccuracy of language must, to a certain degree, prevent the accomplishment of such desire. Whoever views the matter in a true light will see that the powers are as minutely enumerated and defined as was possible, and will also discover that the general clause against which so much exception is taken is nothing more than what is necessary to render effectual the particular powers that are granted. And what they're talking about, that general clause being, because there's two within the enumerated powers. It's the general definition, the general defense and welfare clause at the very front, the preamble. And then the final, the necessary and proper clause. Those clauses were never designed to create general powers or to give the federal government full latitude to do whatever they think necessary and proper or to do these general things. But that's where they are today. So what are you going to do? What can we do to get them out of these practices of doing and exercising powers they have no business exercising? If you ask me, it's pretty clear. The only thing we can do is by forcing an audit of the Constitution, identifying where they're violating them, and getting them back into compliance. It's that simple. Anyway, Mr. Wilson goes on and says, I hope, sir, they will not be the enemies of each other or resemble comets in conflicting orbits, mutually operating destruction, but that their motion will be better represented by that of the planetary system, which each part moves harmoniously within its proper sphere, and no injury arises by interference or opposition. Every part, I must trust, will be considered as a part of the United States. Can cause of distrust arise here, or can any cause of distrust arise here? Is there any increase of risk? Or rather not, the enumerated powers as well demand here as in the present Articles of Confederation? And of course, no. I mean, there are possibilities of risk and distrust, but if they maintain compliance to the Constitution, then I believe that the government is sailing in safe water because they're staying within that we've entrusted them with and powers that we've delegated them. But when they start usurping those things, that becomes problematic. Mr. McKean says this, the framers of the Constitution wisely divided the legislative department into the two houses, subject of the qualified negative of the President of the United States. Though this government embraces only enumerated powers, in a single state, annual elections may be proper, the more so when the legislative powers extend to all cases, but in such an extent of country as the United States, and when the powers are circumscribed, there is not that necessity, nor are there objects of the general government that nature of that nature as to be acquired immediately by every capacity. And so what I really like is here's Mr. McKean and actually talks about the embracement of the enumerated powers and the annual elections. And as long as the government stays within those boundaries as circumscribed, then everything's going to be okay. And he was absolutely right. The last two are coming up here, and then we'll be wrapping up the Pennsylvania, and then we'll be going into the Virginia. So Mr. McKean says this, and the Virginia one is going to take a while, but it's worth it because we're going to go through the rights of guns, all the arguments. There's so much in the Virginia debates because they really break it down. Mr. McKean says this, that in all cases enumerated, except where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, quote, they shall have appeal of jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. It's close quote. From this, it is inferred that the trial by jury is not secured, and an objection is set up to the system because they have jurisdiction between citizens in different states. Regulations under this head are necessary, but the convention could form no one. Let me see here. Let me do this right. Convention could form no one that would have suited each of the states. It has been a subject of amazement to me to hear gentlemen contend that the verdict of a jury shall be without revision in all cases. Juries are not infallible because they are 12 in number. When the law is so blended with the fact as to almost be inseparable, may not the decision of a jury be erroneous? Yet, notwithstanding this, trial by jury is the best mode that is known. Now, we've already found that there have been trials with juries where the juries walk in with biases, where black men have gone to jail and black men haven't gone to jail. And I'm just using one particular demographic. But we see how people exercise their powers within juries. The final comment Mr. McKean makes is, again, because it is unnecessary for the powers of Congress being derived from the people in the mode pointed out by this Constitution and being therein enumerated and positively granted can be no other than what this positive grant conveys. And he's citing Locke on the Civil Governments, Volume 1, or Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 2, Section 140, and in the 13th chapter, Section 152. So if you've got Locke and you have that on civil government, there you go. The interesting thing that I love about these views, especially the Pennsylvania views, is they harmonize with all of the others regarding general governments, or I should say general constitutions and enumerated constitutions, as far as where the powers and the jurisdictions are restrained. They're in complete harmony, even though they have completely different perspectives in looking how this affects them. This is why these ratification debates are so important. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org
www.takeaction.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.